but I can see she's happy to see him in this mood. So Connor did okay, I say when my son takes a breath, and Sam, his mouth full of lasagna, nods, chews, and swallows. Goner's natural, he says. Great work today, pal. He offers a hand, and Connor high-fives it. Next time we tackle the other side. Barring wind or rain, we should be done in a few more days. Connor's face falls a little at that. But what about the wood, Mom? The wood on the side of the house where it's rotted. He's right, I say. We've got some rot. Probably need to replace trim that's gone bad, too. Okay, 3 days. Sam forks up another healthy mouthful of lasagna, dangling strings of cheese. Might be a whole week if you want to spring for that deck on the back.
Yes, Mom, please, can we do the deck?
Connor's look is so earnest that it hits me like a tide and washes away any last lingering disquiet I have. I still trade Javi for the van, but if I was looking for a reason to stay, it's here. Here in my son's eyes. I've been worrying about his introspection, his solitary nature, his silent anger. For the first time, I'm seeing him open up, and it would be cruel and wrong to cut that off purely for a what if. A deck would be nice, I say, and Connor raises both arms in a victory pose. Sam, would you mind doing the work late after Connor gets off school? Sam shrugs.
I don't mind, but it'll go slower. Might take a month if we only put in half days.
That's okay, Connor rushes to say. I only have another week of school, then we can work all day.
Sam Cade lifts his eyebrows and sends me an amused look, and I raise my own and take a bite of my food.
Sure, Sam says. If your mom says it's okay, but only when she's here.
Sam's not a stupid man. He knows how touchy I am, how guarded. And he knows a single dude barging into a family is likely to be suspect of many unpleasant things. I can read in his face that he's well aware and has no trouble playing by whatever rules I set up. I have to admit, it's to his credit. Dinner's a complete success, and while the kids are happily clearing up the mess, Sam and I take our beers out to the porch. The heat of the day is finally giving way to a cooling breeze coming off the lake. But the humidity's something I might never quite get used to. The beer delivers a crisp autumnal note, even though we're not even to deep summer yet. A few boats are skimming the lake as the orange sunset fades out. A four-person sculling craft, a fancy cabin cruiser, and two rowboats. Everyone's heading for shore. Sam says, "You do a background check on me?" It's a surprise, and I pause, beer bottle halfway to my lips, and shoot him a look.
Why would you say that?
Because you seem like a woman who does background checks.
I laugh, because it's true.
Yes.
How's my credit rating?
Pretty solid.
That's good. I really ought to check that more often.
You're not angry? He takes a pull on his drink. He isn't looking at me at all. His attention seems completely on the boats out in the water.
No, he finally says. A little disappointed, maybe. I mean, I think of myself as a really trustworthy sort of guy.
Let's just say I've trusted the wrong people before. I can't help but think of the difference between how Sam Cade just reacted and how I imagine Melvin would have reacted if he'd been sitting here, having just met me. Mel would be angry. Offended. He'd blame me for not automatically trusting him. Oh, he'd have covered it up, but I'd have felt the stiffness in his manner. There isn't any in Sam. He's just saying what he means.
Reasonable, he says. I'm an employee. You have the right to check up on me, especially since I'm going to be around your kids and in your house. Probably the smartest thing you could do, to be honest.
Did you check up on me? I ask.
That surprises him.
He sits back a little and glances my way, shrugs.
I asked around, he says. I mean in the does she pay her bills kind of way. If you mean did I Google you, no. When women do that to men, I assume it's a precaution. When men do it to women, it looks...
stalkery, I finish for him.
Yes.
So what was the word about town about me then?
Like I said, standoffish, he says with a laugh. Same as me, actually. I offer my beer bottle and we clink glass. For a moment we just drink. The scullers reach the far dock. The rowboats have already made port. The fancy cabin cruiser is the last one out on the water, and across the still air I can hear laughter. The lights come on in the boat and reveal four people. A snippet of faint music drifts to me. Three of them are dancing as the pilot heads the cruiser into a private dock on the other side of the lake. Lifestyles of the rich and bored.
"Think they're drinking champagne?" Sam asks me, straight-faced.
"Dom Perignon, with caviar."
Savages. I like mine with smoked salmon toast, but only on days ending with a Y.
"Mustn't overindulge," I agree, in my best posh New England accent. I have a pretty good one from Mother. "So common to be intoxicated on good champagne."
Well, I wouldn't know, because I've never had the good stuff. I think I had a glass of cheap shit at a wedding once.
He holds up his beer.
"This is my version."
"Hear, hear."
"Your son's pretty great, you know."
"I know."
I smile into the growing evening, not quite at him.
"I know."
We finish our beer and I collect the empties.
I pay Sam his day's wages and watch as he walks the short distance up the hill to his cabin.
I watch the lights come on inside his front room, glowing red through the curtains. I go back inside to put the glass in the recycling, and I find the kitchen quiet and clean. The kids are off to their neutral corners, as they so often are. It's a nice, quiet evening, and all I can think of, as I lock up and set the alarms, is that it can't possibly last. But it does. It surprises me more than anything that the next day, Saturday, goes smoothly. Fewer alerts on sicko patrol, no visits from the police, I get more work, Sunday too. Monday the kids are back in school, and at promptly 4 p.m., Connor and Sam Cade are up on the roof, hammering away. Lanny gripes that it's driving her crazy, but turning up her headphones solves that minor issue. A good day slips into another good day, then a week. School lets out, much to the delight of my kids, and Cade becomes a fixture, joining us for breakfast, then taking Connor up to finish the roof. Once that project is complete, they start on replacing the rotten wood trim around the windows and doors. I retire to the office for work and sicko patrol, and it feels almost comfortable, having someone around I can trust, at least a little. By Sunday, there's a new coat of paint on the exterior of the house, and a lot for me to clean up after. But I'm not displeased. Far from it. I'm breathless, paint-spattered, and happier than I've been in a while, because Lanny, Connor, and Cade are just as dirty and tired, and we've accomplished something real together. It feels good. I find myself smiling in an entirely unguarded way at Sam that day, and when he smiles back, it's just as open and free, and I have a sudden flashback to the first time Mel smiled at me. I realize in this moment that Mel's smiles were never open, never free. For all that he played the good husband, the perfect father, it was method acting to him. Never break character. I can see the difference in the way that Sam talks to the kids, the way he makes mistakes and corrects them, says goofy things and smart things, and is a real, natural human. Mel was never those things. I've never had a good mirror to hold him against to see the differences. My father was mostly absentee and not very warm. Children were there to be seen, not heard. I've come to realize that when Mel found me, he read that thirst in me, and the need to fill in. He must have studied for the part. There were times his mask slipped, and I remember every one of them. The moment when I got angry at him about missing Brady's third birthday party was the first. He'd turned to me with such sudden, vicious violence that I'd recoiled against the refrigerator. He hadn't hit me, but he'd held me there, hands on either side of my head, and stared at me with a kind of empty blankness that had terrified me then, and still had the power to do it now. Even when Mel had been perfect in his camouflage, he'd been shallow. His calm had felt stretched and unnatural, and so had his affection. When he'd gone into his workshop,
I imagine that was where the real Mel had come out. He must have lived for the closing of that door, the turning of that deadbolt. As much as I watch Sam, I don't see any of that. I only see a person, a real person. It makes me ill and sad to realize how little I understood what was right in front of me, right in bed with me, the entire 9 years of my marriage. It was my marriage, not ours, because it had never been a marriage to Melvin Royal. I'd been a tool, like the saws and hammers and knives in his workshop. I'd been his camouflage. It is terrifying and soothing to understand this at long last. I never let myself think about it much, but seeing Sam, seeing the kids around him, makes me realize everything that was wrong and artificial in my marriage. I don't tell Sam this, of course. That would be one hell of a strange conversation, especially since I'm in no way going to tell him who I really am. Hell no. But it means something that the kids like him. They're both so smart, and I know that building this safe place for them to grow and do better, it's important. Risky, but necessary. I'm still willing to run if I have to, but not until it's necessary. So far, all's quiet, quieter than it's ever been. By the middle of June, Connor and Sam have the house looking fantastic, and Sam is teaching my son the basics of construction. They're planning on leveling the ground out back, pouring concrete and putting down posts. Lanny hovers on the outskirts of it, making suggestions, until suddenly she's into it too, intently watching as Sam draws out plans with an architect's eye. It's a long-term project. Nobody's in a hurry about it, least of all me. Work keeps coming in on my freelance businesses, to the point that I'm turning things down. I can afford to be picky, and to charge accordingly, and my reputation is growing. Things are definitely looking up. I don't depend on the income from my online work, of course, not completely. I don't have to, because Mel did one thing right. In that awful storage locker where he kept his horrific journals, his trophies, he also kept his escape plan. A duffel bag full of cash. Nearly $200,000, the inheritance from his parents' estate that he'd told me he'd invested in a mutual fund. It sat for years in his storage shed, waiting for him to sense it was time to bolt. He'd never had the chance to take it. He was arrested at work, and he never spent another day as a free man. I turned in the contents of that storage locker to the police, of course I did. But before I did that, I picked up that bag and put it in the trunk of my car. I drove far across town to one of those strip mall mailbox stores and opened up a box in a fake name, made up on the spot, and then took the duffel bag to a UPS location far across town to ship it to my new P.O. box. It was terrifying. I thought I'd get caught, or worse, that someone would open the box and the money would disappear without a trace. I couldn't have complained about it. But it did arrive. I tracked the progress online, and I paid extra to have the mail center hold it for me until I could pick it up. Good thing I did. Because just 2 days later, despite my cooperation with the police, I was arrested, jailed, and awaiting trial. The box with the duffel bag inside was still there almost a year later when I was acquitted, collecting dust in the back corner of the store, which thankfully was still in business. Small miracles. I'd spent half of it on our safety, shelter, and identities before Stillhouse Lake. This house had come remarkably cheap at auction, but I'd spent $20,000 buying it and $10,000 more fixing it up. Still, I have enough, with the income I'm pulling in now, to spend a little. I imagine Mel will be furious about the loss of his carefully hoarded fortune, and that makes me very, very happy. It soothes me to think I'm using that money to pay for a new life. When Cade offers to help me out with the garden, which I've let run wild, I take him up on it, with the provision that he let me pay him for it, which he does. We spend hours together discussing the plans, choosing the specific varietals, planting them together, building stone borders and rambling paths, putting in a small pond and stocking it with little darting goldfish that shimmer in the sun. And little by little, I become aware that I trust Sam Cade. It isn't any specific moment I can point to, or anything he says or does. It's everything he says, does, is. He is the calmest, easiest man I've been around, and every time I see him smile or talk to my kids or talk to me, I realize how poor my choices were before, how barren my life was with Melvin Royal. It had looked full. It was as lifeless as the moon. Before I'm even aware of it, two more weeks go by. My garden looks like something a Home and Garden magazine would feature, and even Lanny seems relatively happy. She moderates her goth to something edgy but cool, and lo and behold, my daughter tells me one day that she's made a friend. Online at first, but she asks, with her usual blend of aggressive reluctance, if I'd drive her to meet Dahlia Brown at the movies. Dahlia Brown, the girl she punched out at school. I'm dubious about this turn of events, but when I meet Dahlia, she seems to be a nice girl, tall, and a little awkward with it, and self-conscious of her braces. Her boyfriend, turns out, dumped her over the metal in her mouth. Best thing that could have happened to her. Connor and I sit in the back of the theater, and Dahlia and Lanny sit together. And by the time Dahlia comes home with us for dinner, she seems to be entirely at ease. So is Lanny. That becomes a regular thing, the movies, as summer wears on. Lanny and Dahlia together, besties. Dahlia picks up the black nail polish and emphatic layers of eye makeup, and Lanny adopts Dahlia's style of flowing floral scarves. By mid-July, the girls are thick as thieves, and they've attracted two more friends. I'm on my guard, of course. One young man is full goth, with a pierced septum, but his boyfriend is helplessly preppy, and they seem wonderfully good together, and wonderfully funny, which is a good thing for my daughter, too. Connor seems much different, too. His D&D buddies are true friends now, and he even, for the first time, tells me he's decided on a career. My son wants to be an architect. He wants to build things, and as he tells me this, I find tears in my eyes. I have been desperate to believe he would have dreams, have a life beyond running and hiding, and now? Now that's true. Sam Cade has given him dreams that I couldn't, and I'm shakily, wonderfully grateful for it. I talk about Connor's new passion to Sam the next night, as we sit together on the porch with our drinks. He listens in silence, says nothing for a long time, and then finally turns toward me. It's a cloudy evening, with the heavy energy of a gathering thunderstorm. We're under a tornado watch in this part of Tennessee, but so far, there's no alert. Sam says, "You don't say much about Connor's dad." I haven't said anything, in fact. I can't. I won't. So instead I say, "Nothing much to say. Connor needed someone to look up to. You gave him that, Sam." I can't see his face in the gloom. I can't tell if I've frightened him or pleased him, or something of both. There's been a guarded tension between us for weeks now, but beyond the occasional, almost accidental brush of fingertips passing tools or a bottle of beer, we haven't so much as touched. I don't know if I can feel romantic toward a man again, and there seems to me to be something holding him back, too. A bad relationship, maybe. A lost love. I don't know. I don't ask. "Glad I could help," he says. His voice sounds odd, but I don't exactly know why. "He's a good kid, Gwen."
"I know."
"Lanny is, too. You're..." He falls silent for a few seconds and takes what sounds like a convulsive swig of his beer. "You're a damn good mom to them." Thunder mutters off in the distance, though we can't see any lightning. Behind the hills, most likely. But I can feel the weight of the rain coming. The air has an unnatural sticky heat to it, and I want to simultaneously fan myself and shiver.
"I've tried to be," I tell him. "And you're right. We don't talk about their dad. But he was vile."
Emotion makes me mute when I try to say more, because another letter arrived from Mel this morning. He's back to his normal cycle, because this one is all small talk, all reminiscences and questions about the kids. It set me on edge, because now, having seen how Sam treats the kids, I can see the difference. Mel was a good dad in the stock photo sense. He showed up, smiled, posed for pictures, but it was all surface.
I know that whatever he felt, whatever he feels now, it's a shallow shadow of real affection. I'm thinking about Mel as I sit here next to Sam, and it makes me want to reach out to Sam, to feel the warmth of his fingers on mine, more as a talisman than as any kind of attraction. I need to drive away Mel's ghost and stop thinking about him. I realize, with a start, that I am on the verge of telling Sam the truth about Mel, the truth about me. If I do, he'll be the first. It's so startling to me that I find myself staring at Sam, at his profile as he sips his beer and stares out at the lake. A distant blur of lightning illuminates his face, and for a strange instant he looks familiar. Not like Sam, like someone else. Someone I can't place. What? He turns his head and meets my gaze, and I feel my face grow warmer. That's so odd, it unnerves me. I don't blush. I can't imagine why I'm suddenly feeling awkward, out of my depth, while sitting on my own porch with a man who's become so familiar to me. Gwen? I shake my head and turn away, but I'm all too aware of his sudden attention. It feels like a searchlight against my face, both warm and terrifyingly revealing. I'm grateful that the clouds have made it artificially dark tonight. I am conscious of the cold glass of the beer bottle I'm holding, the chilly beads of condensation slipping down the back of my hand. I want to kiss this man. I want him to kiss me back. It comes as a shock to me, a genuine and awful shock. I haven't had this impulse in a long, long time. I'd thought it was gone, burned away in the inferno of Melvin's crimes, of the betrayal of trust that reached all the way inside me. Yet here I am, trembling, wanting Sam Cade to press his lips to mine. And I think I know he can feel it too. It's like an invisible wire pulling tight between us. It must have scared him as much as it did me, because he suddenly drinks the rest of his beer in quick, thirsty gulps. I should be going before that storm hits, he says, and his voice sounds off, different, deeper, and darker. I don't say anything because I can't. I can't imagine what I can say, really. I just nod, and he stands up and walks past me to the steps. He's too down when I finally get my voice under control and say, Sam. He pauses. I can hear the muttering grumble of thunder again, and another flash of lightning rips the sky, clear as a knife slash. I roll the bottle between my hands and say, Coming back tomorrow? He almost turns. Still want me back? Of course, I say. Yes. He nods, and then he's gone, walking quickly away. As he does, the security lights we've installed come on, alert to any motion. I watch him as he walks to the gate, to the road, and he's halfway home before the lights click out again. The rain starts 5 minutes later, a hesitant patter at first, and then a steady soft knocking on the roof, and then a thick curtain that shimmers off the edges of the porch. I hope Sam made it home before it hit. I hope the downpour doesn't wash the garden away. I sit in the quiet, listening to the constant roar of the rain, and finish my beer. I'm in trouble, I think, because I've never felt this vulnerable before. Not since I was Gina Royal. It takes a while. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, over the last of the hot, muggy summer, Sam and I relax our guards, put aside our armor. We allow brushes of hands without flinching, smiles without premeditation. It feels real. It feels solid. I finally begin to feel fully human. I don't fool myself that Sam can fix what's broken in me. I don't think he deludes himself about it either. We're both scarred. I've been able to tell that from the beginning. Maybe only the truly damaged can accept each other in the way we do. I think about Mel less and less. I'm glad when the temperature starts to cool on the slippery side of September. School reconvenes, and Connor and Lanny both seem happy. Whoever Connor's bullies were, and he's never confessed to me, his growing pack of friends more than makes up for it. They arrive every Thursday evening for their D&D game, which goes on well into the late hours. I'm delighted by their enthusiasm, their passion, their joy in imagination. Lanny pretends she thinks it's gross, but she doesn't. She starts checking fantasy books out of the library, and she lends them to him when she's done. She stops calling him Squirtle since his friends said they thought it was cool. At the end of September, Sam and I sit in the late, late evening in the living room, watching an old movie. The kids are long off to bed, and I have a glass of wine in my hand, leaning against his warmth. It's a sweet delight, this quiet place. I'm not thinking in that moment about Mel or about anything at all. The wine helps ease the constant vigilant anxiety in me, and it blurs the fear, too. Hey, his voice says quietly by my ear. The tickle of his breath is a tease. You still awake? Very much, I say, then take another drink. He takes the glass from my hand to drain it. Hey! Sorry, Sam says. I need a little courage right now, because I'm going to ask you something. I freeze. I can't breathe. I can't swallow. I can't run. I just sit, waiting for the mask to come off. He says, Do you mind if I kiss you, Quinn? My mind is blank. A snowfield on a glacier, cold and smooth and empty. I'm stunned by the silence inside, the sudden and violent recession of fear. And then I feel warmth. It happens in an instant, as if the warmth was there, waiting, all the time. I say, I'll mind if you don't. It's a tentative thing at first, until we both get our confidence and our bearings. His lips are soft and strong at once, and I can't help but remember Mel's kisses, always somehow plastic. There's none of that studied movement. Sam kisses like someone who means it. He tastes of the rich, dark cherry flavors of the Bordeaux. Everything about that kiss makes me realize how little I know about life, how much I lost in marrying Melvin Royal, how much time I've wasted on him. Sam is the one to break it, and he pulls back, breathing hard, saying nothing at all. I lean against him. He puts his arms around me, and instead of feeling confined, I feel included, protected. Sam, he whispers in my ear, shh, and I don't say anything else. It occurs to me that maybe he's as afraid of this as I am. I walk him outside after the movie. When he kisses me again at the foot of the house steps, it feels like a wonderful promise of better things to come. A letter arrives from the remailing service the next day. I feel my pulse jump, but I'm not as anxious as before. I still take all the usual precautions. I slit the envelope open carefully, wear my blue nitrile gloves, and use utensils to unfold and hold open the paper. This one is the second kind in the cycle, which I expected. Mel's words are blandly normal, like the mask of humanity. He talks about the books he's reading. He's always been a big reader, generally of obscure philosophy and the sciences. He laments the wretched, tasteless food in the cafeteria. He says he's fortunate to have friends who put money in his commissary account so he can buy things to make his prison experience more pleasant. He talks about his lawyer. But then, with a quiet curl of disquiet, I realize something is different about this letter. Something new. When I get to the bottom, I see it. It's a stinger in the tail, and when it strikes me, it plunges its barb in deep. You know, sweetheart, the thing I most regret is that we never got to have that house by the lake that you and I talked about so often. It sounds like paradise, doesn't it? I can almost see it, you sitting on the porch in the moonlight, watching the lake at night. That image gives me peace. I hope you're not sharing it with anyone else but me. I think about the nights I've sat out there on my porch, drinking my evening beer and watching the ripples across the lake in the sunset. That image gives me peace, he says. I hope you're not sharing it with anyone else but me. He's seen us. A photograph, at least. Seen me and Sam together on the porch. He knows where we are. Mom? I flinch and drop the two spoons I'm holding to pin the letter down. When I look up, Connor is standing on the other side of the kitchen counter staring at me. Behind him are Billy, Trent, Jason, and Daryl, his Thursday night friends. I've forgotten what night it is. I'd intended to make Rice Krispies marshmallow treats, and I've forgotten that, too. I quickly fold up the note, slip it back into the envelope, and strip off the gloves to three-point them in the corner trash can. I slip the envelope in my back pocket and say, "Boys, how about some snacks?" And they all cheer. All except Connor, who's gone still and quiet, watching me. He knows something's wrong. I try a smile to reassure him, but I can tell he isn't fooled. With a sick sense of desperation, I try to order my thoughts while I whip together the marshmallow cream and Rice Krispies into their sticky pan, to the delight of the young men. My mind isn't on it, or on them, or on anything but what to do. Run, all my instincts are screaming at me. Just get the van, put the kids in it, run, start over. Make him find you again. But the cold fact is that we have run. We've run and run and run. I've forced my children into an unnatural, damaging life that's cut them off from family, friends, even from themselves. Yes, I've done it to save them. But at what cost? Because looking at where they are now, a full year into being settled, I see them blooming, growing. Running cuts them off at the roots again, and sooner or later, everything good in them will turn stunted and stained from it. I don't want to run anymore. Maybe it's the house, which has become, despite my best efforts, home. Maybe it's the lake or the peace I feel here. Maybe it's the fragile, breakable, careful attraction I finally feel to a good man. No. No, I'm not running, goddamn you, Mel. Not again. It's time to trigger a plan that I set in place a long time ago, one I'd hoped never to have to use. As the boys eat their gooey snacks and roll dice, I step out and call a number that Absalom gave me years ago. I don't know whom it belongs to, and I don't even know if it will work at all. It's a failsafe, a nuclear option. One-time use, and I paid dearly for it. It rings, rings, goes straight to voicemail. There's no greeting, just a beep. "This is Gina Royal," I say. "Absalom says that you'll know what I need done. Do it." I hang up, feeling sick and dizzy, as if I'm standing on the edge of a very steep drop. That name, Gina Royal, it makes me feel like I'm falling backward into darkness and a time I'd rather never existed. Makes me feel like all the progress I've made has been an illusion, something Melvin could take away from me any time he wanted. In the morning, I call the prison where Melvin is being held, and I make an appointment for the next visiting day. 5. I have to get someone to stay with the kids. I think about it. I agonize about it for hours, staring into space, gnawing the inside of my lip raw. I have a few people I could ask, but few, so few. I could put the kids on a plane to their grandmother, I think, but when I check with her, I find she's out of town on a trip. I need to make a decision. I can't leave Lanny and Connor alone, and I can't take them where I'm going. It's an enormous step to take, a gigantic step for someone who doesn't trust anymore. I want to ask Sam. I question that very desire, because Mel has taught me I can't trust my own judgment, and the last thing I want, the very last, is to risk my kids. I wish I knew more women, but the only ones I've become acquainted with in Norton or around the lake so far are chilly and unlikable, or outright hostile toward strangers. I don't know what to do, and it paralyzes me for a long, long time, until finally Lanny throws herself into the chair in my office and stares at me for so long that I have to engage. "What, honey?" "That was my question, Mom. What the hell?" "I don't understand." "Yes, you do," she says, staring harder, narrows her eyes in a way I know she got from me. "You're sitting in here chewing your thumbnail off. You hardly slept. What's wrong? And don't tell me I'm too young to know. Flush that noise." "Flush that" is her newest phrase, and it makes me laugh. I imagine that will change to something much more direct by the time she's 16, but for now, it's a funny, useful phrase. "I need to go out of town," I tell her, "just for the day. You'll mostly both be in school, but I need to leave super early, and I'm back very late. I need someone to be here for you. I take a deep breath.
Who would you suggest?
She blinks, because she probably can't remember the last time I asked, and she won't, because that's not a normal question from me.
Where are you going?
Not important. Stay on topic, please.
Okay, are you going to see Dad?
I hate to hear her say that, like he's still Dad, with that hopeful upward curl in her tone. It makes me shudder, and I know she sees that, too.
No,
I lie, with as bland and even a tone as I can. Just business.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell if my own daughter believes me.
Okay. Well, I guess Sam would be okay. I mean, he's over here anyway fixing stuff. He and Connor are still working on the deck, you know.
Hearing her say Sam's name is a huge relief, and besides, she's right. Sam would normally be here anyway. The deck project has taken on a leisurely pace, a little here, a little there.
I'm just, honey, I won't be here to watch out for you. If you feel at all uncomfortable.
Mom, please. I get the full eye roll this time. If I'd thought he was a creeper, wouldn't I have said so to his face? And to yours? Loudly?
She would have.
Lily was shy. Lanny is not. Something in me eases, though I know I can't afford to rely on a 14-year-old's judgment, however good I think it is. In this, I can only rely on myself. I have to take a risk, and I flinch at the very idea. I take risks for myself. But with them?
With them?
Mom! Lanny is leaning forward now, and I see the earnest stillness in her. I see a ghost of the woman she will become.
Mom, Sam's fine.
He's good.
We're good.
Just do it. Just do it. I take in a deep, slow breath and sit back and nod. Lanny smiles slowly and crosses her arms. She does love to win.
I'll watch him like a hawk, she tells me. And I've got Javier and Officer Graham on speed dial. NBD, Mom.
NBD, I know, stands for no big deal. It is. But I need a leap of faith. And this time, I take it. I pick up my cell phone and lock eyes with Lanny again as I dial the phone number. He picks up on the second ring. Hey, Gwen. The normality and welcome of it steadies me, and my voice sounds almost normal when I say,
I need a favor.
I hear water running. I hear him shut it off and put something down to give me his full attention. Tell me, he says. I'll do it. It's that simple. I'm only going to be gone for about 12 hours, I tell Sam on Sunday night, the night before I have to get on the plane. But I appreciate you staying over. Lanny's responsible, but...
Yeah, but she's 14. He says.
He takes a drink from the beer I've given him, a pecan porter, which he seems to prefer. Craft beers are a gift from God. I'm sipping a Samuel Adams organic chocolate stout, creamy and smooth. It soothes the jitters in my stomach.
You don't want to come home to a trashed house and a mountain of beer cans, right?
Right, I say, though I doubt Lanny would even consider throwing a party. With me gone, she won't feel free, like most girls her age would. She'll feel vulnerable, and she is vulnerable. If her father knows where we are, if someone's really watching us on his behalf, I try not to think about it. I'm well aware that someone out there could be watching now. There are a couple of watercraft out on the lake in the sunset, making for shore. Maybe one of them has a camera trained on my porch. It makes me itchy. Mel will destroy this. He destroys everything. But that is why I'm going to visit him. To be absolutely sure he understands the stakes we are playing for now. I haven't told Sam where I'm going. I wouldn't know how to even start that conversation. I also don't tell him I've set up wireless cameras. There's one focused on the front door, one on the back. One set back from the property on a tree to give a wide view, and one up high in an air conditioning grill in the living and kitchen area. I can easily flip from one view to another on the tablet that came with them. In an emergency, I can email the link to the Norton PD. Not that I don't trust him. Just that I need some kind of reassurance. I do say this. Sam, do you have a gun?
I catch him in mid-gulp, and he turns to look at me with a curious expression as he coughs. I cock an eyebrow at him, and he turns it into a rueful laugh.
Sorry, he says. Caught me off guard there. Yeah, I've got a gun, sure. Why?
Would you mind making sure you have it with you while you're here?
I'm just...
worried about leaving your kids?
Yeah, okay. No problem.
Still, he continues to watch me, and his voice drops a little.
Any specific threats I need to know about, Gwen?
Specific? No, but...
I hesitate, thinking how to put it.
I feel like we're being watched. Does that sound crazy?
Around Kill House Lake? Nope.
Kill House?
Don't blame me for that one. Blame your daughter. I think one of her goth buddies came up with it. Catchy, isn't it?
I hated it. Still House was plenty creepy enough for me.
Well, just take care of them. That's all I ask. I'll be gone less than 24 hours. He nods.
I might work on that deck some, if that's all right.
Sure. Thanks. On impulse, I reach out to him, and he takes my hand and holds it for a moment. That's all.
It isn't a kiss. Isn't even a hug. But it's something strong, and it makes both of us sit for a moment savoring it.
He gets up eventually, draining the last of his pecan porter, and says, I'll be back early morning before you leave, yeah?
Yeah, I agree. I leave for Knoxville at 4 a.m. The kids will be off to school by 8, and they can get themselves up and on the bus. You'll have the place to yourself until they're back at 3. I'll be in sometime after dark.
Sounds good. I'll be sure to eat all your food and watch only the highest dollar pay-per-view. Mind if I buy a bunch of stuff on your account on the shopping channels?
You know how to party, Sam.
Damn right I do. He gives me a full, sweet smile and leaves to walk up the hill toward his small cabin. I watch him go, hardly aware that I'm smiling, too. It feels normal. Normal, I think, as the smile finally fades, is so dangerous now. I'd been fooling myself into thinking I could live in that world, but my world is the one beneath, the one in the shadows, the one where nothing is safe or sane or permanent. I'd almost forgotten that with Sam. If I stay here, I am helping my kids. But I'm risking everything, too. There are no good answers, but this time I'm not just going to be strong. I'm hitting back. The next day, I take an eye-wateringly early morning flight from Knoxville to Wichita, where we once lived, and from there I drive a rental car to El Dorado. It's got a strangely industrial feeling, like a large manufacturing campus surrounded by miles of nothing, but there's no mistaking what it really is once you see the shimmering fences around it in a lace ruff of razor wire. I've never been here before. I don't know how to do this. The air smells different, and it reminds me of my old life, my old house that's long gone. It was foreclosed on by the bank while I was in jail. A month after that, someone had it set on fire and burned it to ruins. There's a memorial park there now. When I want to punish myself, I look at the spot where I once lived on Google Maps. I try to overlay the house on top of the park from memory. It seems to me that the large stone memorial block sits in the center of what had once been Mel's garage and killing floor. That seems appropriate. I don't take the detour to look on the way to El Dorado. I can't. I'm focused on one thing and one thing only, as I follow instructions from the guard on where to park, what I can take inside with me. I've left my Glock locked in my Jeep's gun safe back in Knoxville, and all I have with me now are the clothes on my body, a preloaded cash card for $500, phone and tablet computer, and my old Gina Royal ID. I endure the sign-in process where my ID is scrutinized, my fingerprints are taken, and I am subjected to stares and whispers from not just the prison staff, but other women coming to see family. I don't meet anyone's gaze. I am an expert at being remote.
The guards are certainly interested. I've never been to see Melvin before. They'll be hotly discussing it up and down the corridors. Next, everything but my clothes is taken and stored in a guard station, and then I'm strip-searched. It's a humiliating, invasive process, but I grit my teeth and get through it without complaint. This is important, I think. Mel likes to play chess. This move, this visit, is my checkmate. I can't afford to flinch at the cost of making it. Dressed again, I'm shown to another waiting room, where I pass the time reading a dog-eared gossip magazine left by some woman before me. It's an hour before a guard appears to summon me on. He's young and hard-faced, this one, with sharply clinical eyes. African-American. A bodybuilder, I think. Nobody I'd want to cross. He leads me to a small claustrophobic booth with a stained, worn counter, a chair, a phone fastened to the cubicle wall. Scratched, thick plexiglass for a barrier. There's a whole row of booths, and desperate people sit hunched in every one of them, searching for some peace, some humanity in a place that offers none of that. I hear whispers of conversation as I go. Mama's not feeling right. Brother's been locked up for driving drunk again. Can't afford to pay the lawyer this time. I wish you could come home, Bobby. We miss you. I sink into the chair without feeling it, without thinking, because I'm looking through the cloudy plastic barrier at Melvin Royal, my ex-husband, the father of my children, a man who swept me off my feet with charm and grace, who proposed to me in a swinging bucket on top of a Ferris wheel at the state fairgrounds. And it doesn't escape me now that he'd waited until I was stranded and isolated to do it. I'd thought it wildly romantic at the time. I can guess he found it fun to imagine me plummeting to the ground, or arousing to have me completely at his mercy. Everything he's done is tainted now to me. Every smile was just mechanics. Every laugh was manufactured. Every public sign of affection was just that. For the public. And always, always, the monster lay just under the surface of it all. Not a large man, Mel. Deceptively strong. But we learned at the trial that he still relied on tricks and guile to lure women in close, and stun guns and zip ties to keep them under control once he had them. He's put on weight, a soft, shivering layer of fat over those long muscles, and it's blurred the once sharp line of his jaw. He was vain about his looks, and about mine. He always wanted me to be trim and neat, and reflect well on him. There's not much else I can recognize easily about him right now, because he's been beaten to shit. I let myself gaze at the destruction, the ripening bruises, the cuts. His right eye completely closed, his left just barely cracked open. There are ugly red bruises around his throat, and I can see the clear outlines of fingers. His left ear is heavily bandaged. When he reaches for the phone, I see that several of his fingers are broken and taped together for healing. I can't tell you how happy all this makes me. I pick up the phone and hold it to my ear, and Mel's voice comes out raspy but controlled as ever. Hello, Gina. It took you long enough. You look great, I tell him. And to my surprise, my voice sounds entirely normal. I'm shaking inside, and I don't even know if it's from visceral fear or savage joy at seeing him hurt. He says nothing. No, seriously. That's really a good look on you, Mel. Thanks for coming, he says, as if he fucking invited me. As if it's a dinner party. I see you got my letter. I see you got my answer, I tell him, and I lean forward to make sure he can clearly see my eyes, the coldness burning in them like dry ice. He makes me afraid, constantly afraid, but at the same time, I am completely unwilling to let him see that. This was a warning, Mel. Next time you play with me, you fucking die. Is that clear enough? Do we need to have another round of bullshit threats? He doesn't seem afraid. He has the same indifference that I remember from the arrest, the trial, the sentencing. though there's that one particular picture of him looking over his shoulder in the courtroom that betrays the monster in his eyes. It's chilling precisely because it's true. He hardly seems to be listening to me. The noise in his head, the fantasy, must be very strong right now. I wonder if he's imagining taking me apart as I scream, taking our kids apart, too. I think he probably is, because the pupil that I can see has contracted to a greedy little pinpoint. He's like a black hole. Not even light can escape.
"You must have brought yourself some friends in here," he says. "That's good. Everybody needs friends, don't they? But you surprise me, Gina. You were never good at making friends."
"I'm not fucking playing with you, asshole. I came to make sure you understand that you need to forget about me and leave us alone. We are not connected, not in any way. Say it." My palms are sweating. One grips the phone, the other is pressed on the stained counter. I can't see his eyes very well. I need to see his eyes to see what's looking out of them.
"I know you didn't mean for me to be hurt like this, Gina. You're not a cruel woman. You never were."
His voice. God, it's exactly like the one in my head, still. A perfectly calm, reasonable sort of voice, with a hint of compassion. He's practiced it, I'm certain of that. Listened to himself, adjusted it to hit just the right notes. Predator camouflage. I think about all those nights we sat side by side, his arm around my shoulders as we watched movies or talked. About the nights I curled up to his warmth in our bed, and he said something in that same soothing tone. "You fucking liar." "I mean it," I tell him. "Every bruise, every cut. Get it through your head, Mel. It doesn't work on me anymore."
"What doesn't?"
"This charade." He's silent for a while. I could almost believe I'd hurt his feelings if I legitimately thought he had any. He doesn't. None that I'd recognize in any way. And if I managed to bruise them as much as his flesh, I wouldn't care at all. When he does speak again, his voice is quite different. Same voice, I suppose, but the tone, the timbre, very different. He's dropped the disguise, the way he drops it every third letter he sends.
"You shouldn't make me angry, Gina."
I hate hearing my old name in his mouth. I hate the way he almost purrs it. I don't respond because I know not responding throws him off. I just watch him, sitting quietly in my chair, and suddenly he leans forward. The guard stationed on his side of the barrier focuses on him like a laser beam, and his hand hovers near the stun gun he's carrying. I guess they don't want to shoot prisoners in front of their family members. Mel doesn't seem to notice or care that the guard's behind him. He lowers his voice even more to say,
"You know, your internet fans out there are still looking for you. It'd be a shame if they ever found you. I can't imagine what they'd do. Can you?"
I let the silence hiss between us like a live wire, and then I slowly lean forward until I'm an inch away from the plexiglass, 2 inches from him. The first hint I have that they know where I am, I will put an end to you.
"Tell me how you plan to do that, Gina, because I have the power here. I've always had the power."
I just stare at him. He has the phone in his right hand, but his left hand is under the level of the tabletop, blocked by his body from the guard, who is almost directly behind him. The guard is now looking at me, not at Mel. I realize with a jolt that Melvin is massaging his crotch. It's making him hard, thinking of how he could arrange my murder. I feel sick, but I do not feel horrified. I'm past that now. I can't see his eyes, but I know the monster's looking out. And I'm revolted. I'm angry. I keep my voice low as I say, "Take your hands off your dick, Melvin. Next time you piss me off, you won't have one left. Understand?" He gives me an untroubled smile.
"If I die in here, everything I know goes online. I've made arrangements, just like you have."
I believe him. It's the kind of thing Mel would do. One last spit from the grave.
He wouldn't care that it destroys his children. Not anymore. He loved them once, I have no doubt of that. But it was a selfish kind of love. He was proud of them because he was proud of himself. He loved them because they loved him, without question or condition. But in the end, there's only Mel, and walking meat for Mel to use. I've learned that the hard way. Violence is all he understands, which is why I've called in this favor from Absalom. I want Melvin to clearly feel what he risks when he comes after us. Fear of death is the only thing that can possibly persuade him to leave us alone. I don't know if he can fear pain. I know he experiences it, but fear is a tricky thing with him. One thing is certain, though. He won't want to die or be maimed for life. Not unless it's on his own terms. He takes control to sickeningly perverse levels. Here's the deal, I tell him. You leave us alone and forget about coming after us, and I won't have you fucked with an iron bar and beaten to death in the shower. How's that? His lips are split and swollen, but he smiles, and as he does, the purplish skin stretches and a dark crimson split opens, threading a line of fresh blood down his chin. It drools on his broken fingers and wicks into the clean cotton bandage in a spreading red stain. That's the monster, all over him. No longer in hiding at all. He doesn't seem to notice or care. Sweetheart, he says, I never knew you had it in you, all this violence. It's honestly sexy. Fuck you. Let me tell you how this is going to go, Gina. He likes saying my old name, rolling it around in his mouth, tasting it. Fine. Let him have it. I'm not Gina anymore. I know you. You're no more mysterious than a wind-up toy. You're going to go running back to your rural little patch and pray that I won't follow through on my threat. You'll dither around for a day, maybe two. Then you'll realize you can't count on my goodwill, and you'll grab my children and run away again. You're destroying them, you know, with all this running and hiding. You think they won't break? Brady's going silently mad, and you don't even see it. But I see it. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and you're going to run away and rip up their lives and doom them to another slide down the spiral. I hang up in the middle of his calm, eerily even diatribe, stand up, and stare at him through the dirty plastic. Other people have leaned against this barrier. I can see the sweaty outlines of handprints and the gauzy impression of lipstick. I spit. The saliva hits the glass and rolls down. It makes it look like he's crying, except for the sickening, constant smile on his face. For a moment, I'm overcome with it all. The Lysol and sweat stink of this place, the sight of fresh blood dripping from his chin, the slick, awful way his voice still worms inside me and sets off tremors of fear and disgust and self-doubt, because I once trusted this thing. He's still talking into the receiver. I don't pick up the phone again, but I lean both palms on the counter and lock eyes with the monster. The man I married, the father of my children, the murderer of more than 12 young women whose bodies undulated under the water as they slowly, slowly rotted away. One of them's never been identified. She's not even a memory. I hate him with so much force that it feels like dying. I hate myself. Two. I'm going to kill you, I tell him, enunciating so clearly I know he can make out the words through the soundproofing. You filthy fucking monster. I'm well aware that they're recording me through the camera set up high in its protective bubble overhead. I don't give a damn. If I end up on the wrong side of this barrier someday, maybe that's just the price I have to pay to protect my kids. I can live with that just fine. He laughs. His lips part, his mouth opens, and I see the raw, dark cavern of his mouth. I remember that he bit his victims with those teeth, chewed off pieces of them. I think that the look in his eyes must have been the same as he gives me now, straining to open up those puffy, bruised lids. It doesn't look human at all. Run, I see him say, enunciating it so I can lip-read.
run away. I walk instead, slowly, calmly, because fuck him.
On the way back to the airport, I am shaking so hard from delayed reaction that I have to pull over and buy a sweet sugary drink to calm my nerves.